I'm Adam Coleman, inviting you to the fifth season of The Cosmic Library from LitHub. This season, we go on our tiniest reading adventure yet, into short stories in the U.S. But this too turns out to be almost all-encompassing.
I think short stories are essentially brief encounters with felt life.
That's Oxford literary scholar Andrew Kahn, who gives us a deep history of the short story. And we hear from The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman, who explains her work as an editor of short fiction.
You know, if you are melding with another person, you don't turn that person into you, but you get to know the ins and outs of that person. So, and it's sort of like that. I always feel involved with the stories.
We bounce around between the history and current life of short stories with the novelist Justin Taylor.
The nice thing about it going out of fashion is that it really frees you up to relate to it in a different way.
This being the Cosmic Library, we make sure to go way beyond U.S. short stories, too. Here's the Washington Post critic, Becca Rothfeld.
A lot of Kafka short stories, I think, gesture at or describe sort of nightmarish geographies or architectures.
And the actor Max Gordon Moore reminds us just how wild short stories can be. With a reading in its entirety of Wakefield, the intensely strange, classic Nathaniel Hawthorne story.
He had contrived, or rather he had happened to dissever himself from the world, to vanish.
Get ready for all that and more in a season about short stories, small windows into vast universes. It's season 5 of The Cosmic Library, available soon wherever you go for podcasts.
Well, welcome to the Maris Review.
Thanks, Maris.
I'm so happy to be here with Lauren Meckling. She's a contributor at Vogue, who I've seen around the publishing world for many, many years now.
Yes.
And she's the author of How Could She?, which is her first novel for adults. Welcome.
Thanks.
Yay.
I love your podcast.
Thank you. We were just talking about how your book is about three main characters who work in media or around media.
Correct.
And people are starting to do that Sex and the City thing where they say, well, I'm a Carrie.
I'm a Miranda. Yes.
Yes.
Which is so fun. And it's fun because the characters who people relate to are often not the ones who I would connect them with. But it's a game I play in my head where I think about the nuances that I've written into each of the characters.
Yes.
And then I realize, oh, that one actually is quite, she often gets quite depressed, or she's quite, you know, touched by these strange things that she sees on the street. And then it'll make more sense.
So, yeah. Yeah. So I was saying I'm a Rachel, but I don't have children, which means that I'm neurotic, but also creative.
And Rachel's very giving. She's sort of a busybody, and she cares and worries about other people.
And then I'm a bit of a Geraldine.
Well, yes, you have your beautiful new podcast.
Yes, I do.
Not to spoil it, but
we're gonna talk about the idea that we are talking on a podcast right now after you've written this book.
It's
wild.
Yes.
And then, of course, there's Sunny, who I just told you is the character my poor little Jewish soul could not relate at all, but I wanted to so much.
Sunny is that shiny woman. Everyone has a Sunny.
Yes.
A person who exists to inspire us and taunt us and be just a little out of reach and to represent the life we don't have.
Absolutely. And so do you want to just give us a brief description of the book? Tell us.
Yeah. So How Could She is a novel about the trouble with female friendship.
Yeah.
And it has three main characters who, over the course of a year, love each other and manipulate each other and get in each other's business and end up trading places. There's Geraldine, who is a lovable woman who people have come to worry about very much. She has found herself, she's living in Toronto. She's the only one of the three who has yet to figure out how to make it in New York. So she's sort of left behind, and she's been left behind by her fiancé, who didn't marry her 4 years ago when they were supposed to get married. And she's watching Sherlock in bed, and she's quite sweet and yet a little delusional. And her friends, they work together to maintain her fantasies about the life that she should be living or would be living if things had gone just a little differently. And so Geraldine maintains very close ties with her two friends who are in New York. One of them is Rachel, who is the mother of a baby and a failed young adult writer who is driving a bus where the wheels keep falling off in her life, but she's determined to get to a point where everything feels settled and she feels good about herself. And it's hard, especially because there are people like Sunny, who was once their peer. They stood shoulder to shoulder when they all worked together at a magazine in their early 20s in Toronto. And Sunny has managed to make herself into this it girl watercolor artist, tastemaker, West Village
Style
royalty
guru.
Oh, yes. I mean, I want to know what Sunny thinks about and what she likes. I would love to surround myself with all of the things that she yes. has anointed as cool.
The yoga and the restaurants and the
yes, and the monographs. Yes.
The only big criticism I've heard about your book is that it hits too close to home.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yes.
For so many of us who have worked in media since our early 20s.
Well.
No, I mean, that's a compliment, actually.
Well, thank you. It's a little ugly, yes. I think it's emotionally ugly, too.
So you just wrote an op-ed for The Times, which is very directly linked to the book, about how there's no sanctioned way for friends to break up, basically.
Yes. It was sort of the self-help book as an article that I needed for myself. Mm-hmm. It was an article about how to accept the fact that friendships often dissolve, leave you behind.
Yeah.
Or sometimes you leave them behind, but how to make sense of the fact that people who mattered so much to you might not be in your life in such a strong way anymore.
When you look at the trajectory of Sunny and Geraldine and Rachel, yeah, there are so many different outcomes. And
they have no business being friends in the present moment of the story. They're all bound right. together by their past, and they all feel this huge sense of obligation to continue to be there for each other. And they're struggling with, I think, trying to redefine their relationships in light of who they have become and who they are trying to become.
As a single.
Yeah. As a married
who doesn't have a kid,
uh-huh.
I certainly find that there are some friendships that end right then, and then there are some that still continue, and it takes effort.
It takes flexibility. Mm-hmm. It takes readjusting and reorienting, and often it takes space having and crying and missing each other.
Absolutely.
And then,
and prioritizing and
yes.
helping. You know, I've been trying to be as helpful as possible.
It's so hard. When I became a mother, that created some unforeseen tensions with some of my closest friends. And it also created some wonderful relationships with people who I would not have been friends with prior to being a mother. So, but the funny thing is that it's not something that you can predict. I feel like there's no commonality between the friends of mine where our friendship survived motherhood and those that didn't.
From the other side, there is no way I could predict who once they had children would still want me to take an active role in their lives.
But I think also huge moments like that in people's lives can also serve as a excuse or reevaluation yeah. point to, I don't know, shut the door and to move on. I think, you know, I've had a very, very close friend who, you know, ripped my heart into pieces when I became a mother and we were not friends anymore. And I don't think it was about these changes in my life that
right.
didn't match her life. I think she had had enough of me.
And that's interesting to me too, because I think for the most part, my friendships have been ones where we get along for a certain amount of time and then nothing bad happens. There's no fight. It's just like we're different people.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's good, right? I mean,
yeah,
if you weren't
is.
Different people and everyone stayed the same, that would be pathetic. But
yeah,
I think it's
true. What a good point.
But I think in the case of Geraldine, I think her two friends have a really hard time accepting her growth because it's so, and I think we all do that to a certain degree. We all, you know, think if we watch Friends suddenly become, you know, successful on one level or suddenly become pathetic on another level, it's hard for us to adjust our versions of who our friends are in our heads.
Of course. And then we have to consult with the other friend
right.
about how we feel and let their opinion also influence us.
Yes. I mean, what else would we talk about?
Yeah, that's right, right. and I just think it's also so true for people who start out as friends in their 20s that by their 30s, they're going to be living in different places, even if they're in the same city. And they're going to have different social circles. And some are going to be wealthy.
Yeah, some become fancy.
Some become fancy. I did not become fancy. That's okay.
You're fancy.
I'm like...
You're Maris. You're you're the coolest.
Thank you.
You're a one-namer.
Just like Prince.
Yeah.
It's so hard. One, keep your own identity when you're trying to get to retain friendships from these other times. And then also, it's easy to feel like you don't know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah.
So Geraldine becomes successful because she
discovers,
knows. Yeah.
No, go ahead. You say the magical world of podcasts. Is that what you were going to say?
Indeed.
No?
Indeed.
Yeah. She's an oracle. She, you know, she's trying initially to make it in the hard and sharp-elbowed world of mainstream media, and people are not really, they're opening the door, but only a crack, and it's so painful.
One of my favorite lines is she tells someone when they ask what she does, she says, I go on informational interviews.
Yeah, she does a lot of that. Yes, I mean, she's bottling up a lot of frustration and sadness, and she ends up, yes, at the time of the book, it's set in 2017 when podcasts were a lot different than they are even now.
Yeah.
They were, you know, baby, fledgling, weird, often DIY feeling experiments. And so she takes that, the short stick, so to speak, mm-hmm. and ends up making, I don't know, making something great out of it. She, you know, she uses her podcast to express herself.
Yeah.
And then it was fun, you know, writing it just to think of her friends sort of eavesdropping in and listening and trying to gain clues about what her state of mind was like or what she was up to now.
Just, and isn't that, I do that too when my friends write books, right? Like trying to read between the lines of what they're writing to see how they're doing. And I guess that Geraldine's friends were listening to the podcast in the same way. When you were writing the book, were you imagining what kinds of podcasts you might be on?
For me?
Yeah.
No. And it's very strange being on one. And I've never seen one, or I hadn't seen one, by which I mean I hadn't seen people creating one.
Right.
And I had this vision in my head of what a podcast studio looked like and like what went on behind the scenes. And I thought a lot about it, about, you know, because I listen to podcasts all the time, but I try to think the people, like, for instance, we're sitting here at a table in a room where people probably have
meetings
during the day. We're in a publishing office.
Yeah.
And there's books all over the walls, and with this big mahogany or faux mahogany table. And people are probably looking at their phones a lot and wishing they didn't have so many meetings. But there's two little microphones and that's it. But I had always imagined it to be like this elaborate contraption, you know, something along the lines of like a television studio.
Right.
With people and so many glass panels and so many knobs and so many headphones.
And I've certainly done a bunch of them, and it's run the gamut for sure of like going to someone's home and sitting on their couch and holding onto a microphone.
Yes.
To actually feeling like you're in a TV studio.
And did you like that?
I've tried to roll with the punches a little bit. Yeah. You know, but I also love that Geraldine I wrote this down because I loved this because she gets to ask the real questions.
Oh, gosh. Well, right. And Geraldine also has this habit of asking people these searching questions in real life. So in the beginning, we see her at dinner parties with her chin in her hand and saying, so what do you think pajamas say about other people? Or what is sign of a great puppeteer. And, you know, and I think there's an element of eye rolling around her about why is this person so ponderous and why is she always thinking things? And then she's able to use that to her great advantage in her show.
So I'm trying to be more ponderous. I'm going to steal one of your questions.
Oh, a Geraldine question?
A Geraldine question. What is friendship?
Ouch. I guess that's the answer. Friendship is, let's see, I know I'm obsessed with it. It is the thing that makes life so worth living and so much fun. And it is the thing that I spend the most amount of minutes and brain cells obsessing over. Friendship is, it's changed over, you know, over life, my life.
Of course.
And I think it used to be a very codependent relationship that would fend off loneliness. Mm-hmm. And I think as I've gotten older and I've become aware of the fact that there really is no way to nourish all of my friendships to the degree which I ideally would.
Right.
I'm not able to have lunch every single day with every single one of my friends. And right. You know, and
drop by before work and say hi.
I mean, that sounds so great. Yes. And instead I spend so much, I spend 99% of my time alone and it's horrible. You know,
me too.
Yeah.
But we were also, I feel like we're taught that if you're a woman, that friends can be your family or should be your family.
Yes. Especially because women are conditioned to be really good at speaking about our feelings.
Yes.
And if you're in a heterosexual relationship, sometimes it's the conversations with women that you need.
Yeah.
But I think now friendship is actually something I'm a little more scared of, and it's more fragile in the sense that I'm just so aware of how terrible things can go or how delicate it is. And so for me, it's much more of a true appreciation of somebody, often from more of a distance than I wish there was between us, but it's an acceptance of them and of the situation, the, you know, the circumstances that we're in.
Yeah. And you've written a book about it. So obviously.
Apparently.
Yeah. So like, do your friends have a kind of meta sense of, like, you know, have they read your book and either seen themselves or felt a certain way?
There's one friend of mine who saw herself and it was hilarious. She had a request. She said there was a line in there that she found very, very troubling. And I was going through every single thing I'd written that came out of this character's voice. And I, you know, so nervous. And it was simply a line in which she explains that women are such generous. She's a lesbian and she says that women are such generous lovers. And she said, I don't feel comfortable with that. I don't want these generalizations in the book. But she was totally fine with the purple dildo scene.
Perfect.
That was not that inventive. And, you know, it's funny. The response that my friends who've read it are giving me is less about recognizing clues from my life and more about recognizing things in their lives.
Yeah.
Such as what we were talking about, the, you know, it's like the Myers-Briggs you know, a certain type of modern woman now of
Rorschach.
You know, so that's what I'm hearing the most of. Or also there's just a lot of parallels people are seeing in terms of, oh my gosh, that same thing happened to me. Or I remember when I felt like a friend of mine was generous, but only to a certain degree. And I was so resentful that she didn't fully, you know, give me all the help I needed, et cetera.
And then, of course, I assume that for your friends who work in media, there's just the way things have changed in 15 years is crazy.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
And so I was like you in that I started out in publishing, but I was in books. I remember using the photocopier all the time. Like, that was most of my job. And filing things and faxing things.
Yeah, my job, the fax, yes. And my first couple jobs were just answering a man's telephone.
Yeah.
Remember?
Like, of course.
There was, we didn't want, yeah, when I worked at the Paris Review when I was 21, there was one computer that arrived in the office and it sat in the middle on this table and people would take turns standing over this. It was like one of those tiny candy colored Macs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like Felicity had.
Yes. It was pink, but everything was written in these enormous books.
And so
there's
now,
no, like, Slack.
There's
no gig economy.
There's no gig. I mean, people are getting paid.
Yes, that too.
Like, you could make a living being a writer.
Oh, yeah. It was a fabulous, fabulous thing to become.
Yeah. And it's such a weird time now. And this, you talk about this a lot in the book, like, in this age when things are going digital, I'm using air quotes, and magazines are folding, and the way that companies even make money is different from the way it used to be.
Right. They're sort of branding content on the
side. They're branding,
sort of
content,
pimping themselves out in order to, they're suddenly treating these once money makers as their, you know, as their endangered species. You know?
Trying to figure out our places in all of that is very challenging.
Yes.
Hence, we're here on my podcast.
I know.
You wrote a book.
I know. Who would have thunk?
Your husband works in book publishing now.
Yes, you're the first person who's brought that up.
Did he have advice? Did you seek
pivotal
advice?
He basically should have his name on the spine of the book. He made me take the book out of a drawer or out of a folder on my computer when I hadn't touched it for a year. And he had me print the pages out and he read them and he believed in them and said, you have to do this. So that was, without him, this book would not be in the world.
That's lovely. And then did he have specific insights into, like, the more nitty gritty parts of publishing a book? Like, here's how you deal with the copy editor, like whatever. I say this as someone whose spouse has a book coming out in September.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've been overbearing in terms of backseat driving.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. He had me take the pages out and he, you know, he sent them to his agent, who then sent them to an agent down the hall who took it on. And yes, he is very, very aware of what everything means. And on that end, at this stage, 7 days before the book comes out, he is being very peppy and smiley.
Good.
And yes, yeah, we had to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, he wants to know. Apparently, there's some numbers that I'm able to access.
Oh.
And I don't want anyone to access. I don't want to.
Or, like, he could know, but he should talk to your agent or something.
Yes, he should. Yes. They could have lunch.
They could absolutely have lunch. And then, of course, I have to bring up your other big, what you're known for.
Oh, yes.
Is the aesthetic of clog life.
Yes. Which was an unexpected detour on my trip here. I'm not going to say journey here. I was laid off from my fancy magazine job a few years ago. And I was a wreck. And I had lunch with an incredibly, incredibly nice, I won't say friend because I'd met her once before, Jessica Winter. She's an editor of The New Yorker. She's so nice. She reached out to me. I mean, this is the thing about thinking about friendship, too. It's just, you really never know who. Anyway, she reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to have lunch just because she was so sorry and worried or whatever.
Oh, that's
and
so sweet.
At lunch, I said, you know, I want to write an article about clogs, you know, and now that I don't work in a skyscraper and wear high heels, I'm becoming a clog person. Like, this is my new life. And
just for listeners, Lauren is in fact wearing a lovely pair of clogs right now.
They're Polish and I don't know. Yeah, they're from apparently some obscure town where they're, you know, made by hand. And just hearing that, I said, I need those clogs. But anyway, so I wrote an article for thenewyorker.com about my transition to cloghood.
Right.
And it hit a nerve. And I think it hit a nerve really because everyone, you know, it's really about losing your job and becoming one of those creative people who's trying to style herself to look cool and to look like, you know, she belongs in this new ethereal life where there isn't that much structure, but maybe she's doing very cool things. Who knows what a clog person is really doing?
We hope. I mean, in my head, there's a whole idea of who the clog woman is and what she's into.
Is she funny? No, right?
I think she's funny.
I don't know why I'm asking that. But the way you said that, the clog woman and what she's into. I mean, I think she is a pill, but I think the whole idea of her is hilarious.
I think that's probably true.
It sort
too.
Of straddles the line between funny and just very, you know, self-indulgently, self-caringly, organically floaty. In any event, this article was something a lot of people read and wrote to me about, I think, because it either drove home their fears about losing their purchase on the lives that they had created for themselves, or they'd actually been through it.
Right.
And I started my friend Eviana Hartman, she said, you have to just start an Instagram account. This is too hilarious.
Yeah.
And so ever since then, every day I've posted at least one picture. And now I don't really have to spend very much time, you know,
people get
curating.
Because, right.
Yes,
submissions.
I have my clog elves who send me submissions. You know, seen on, you know, the L train or seen in OK Magazine or, yes, or something will just sort of feel cloggy, even if it's, you know, not a clog, like a Le Creuset pot. Could go right up there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in terms of what a clog woman might be reading, aside from how could she, obviously.
Yes. Right. That's her Bible.
That's her Bible. What else is she reading?
Oh, she's very excited about the new Rachel Cusk essay collection.
Yeah, of course.
That's coming out. I think she's going to be reading Three Women by Lisa Tadeo.
Yep.
I think she might go through a little back in the past. I think she might check out Iris Murdoch, but then might get distracted and read a cookbook instead.
You're like calling me out.
You're one of us.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just bought another Iris Murdoch book that I love her.
Okay, send me a picture. Yes, it's wonderful. Send me a picture of you in your clogs.
Okay.
With Iris.
Okay. I will. Ooh, you're listening to one of my dreams.
What do you think she'd be reading?
I like that the idea that she'd be reading Lisa Tadeo because she wants to know.
She's not very sexy. She doesn't really have much sensuality, but she's very interested in.
She wants to know about what women are like these days, even though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Even though she might be.
She is one.
Yes, she's. Yeah, she is one, but she spends a lot of money to veil her true womanliness, right? Or it's a different kind of womanhood.
Yeah. I like the idea that perhaps she'd be into any NYRB reissues. Like whatever like the hot book is from the NYRB.
She really likes a good cover too.
Of course. I mean, the Dud Avocado would be maybe a book for her.
Oh, yeah. She has that. She has the Eve Babbitts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Definitely. But there's a lot of mainstream fiction that she probably would enjoy, but she's not going to own up to it. And she certainly is going to not pick it up off the table. Because it just wasn't designed by the cool enough, the right person.
So now let's switch and let's talk about you.
Me?
What do you love to read? What were there any books that informed the way that you wrote How Could She?
I have no idea because I read a lot.
Right.
You know,
read like me.
I didn't make a vision board of the five authors who I wanted this book to bring to mind. But I will say my favorite writer is Barbara Pym.
Ah.
Rest in peace.
Yes.
And I read and I reread and I read and I reread her I spend a lot of time reading things that haven't come out yet because I write book criticism.
Right.
And I get lots of galleys and there's a lot of, you know, checking things out even that I don't write about. But I spend most of my reading time doing that. But Barbara Pym is the cornerstone of my soul. And, she's very, I would say, morbidly a little sad and a little witty. And I
love it. If if someone were to start out reading their first Pym, what would you recommend?
Well, I like her last one, but I think it might turn people off because it's actually quite morbid. It's called A Quartet in Autumn, and it's hilarious, but also really depressing. It's about four. It's also an office comedy, a bit like this. It's about four people who are on the verge of retirement, and they work in an office in London. And it's unclear throughout the entire book what their company does or what they do. It's just known that they're not needed around anymore, and everyone is ready for them to move on to the end, the last chapter of their lives. And they are each other's, I would say, closest friends, although they have they know very little about each other.
I think I'm too emotionally fragile to read that right
now. Like the literary equivalent of eating something strange out of Tupperware in a public space. So her the jolly starter Pym would be Excellent Women.
Excellent Women.
Yes. Cool. Have you not read her yet?
Nope.
I'm delighted. I hope you like her.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you've been watching or reading or listening to that you want to talk about?
Oh my God.
You don't have to.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just on Twitter. No.
Anyone you've been following on Twitter who you want to talk about?
I like the, there's an Instagram account that makes me very happy.
What is it?
It is called, one of those grab bag contribution accounts where people send in photographs of human beings standing around in very strange positions. Do you see it?
Oh my God, I love it.
Is it called People
Standing? It's called People Standing.
Yeah, it is.
It's so wild. Strange and hilarious. And I love how unvain it is. You know, on Instagram, it's so refreshing to just see people's ugly bodies.
Yes. Not just like getting their best angles with their best selfie faces.
Yeah, yeah, but I've been reading books that are not at all old. They're quite new, but to me, because I tend to read in the future, I'm taking a little breather from book criticism with work on, you know, my book coming out. And so I have a small pile of, you know, the ones that got away and that I haven't read yet.
Right.
So An American Marriage is on the pile, and The Great Believers.
Yep. Oh, you'll enjoy them.
Have you read them?
Yes. You'll enjoy both of them after book tour or during book tour. I don't know how you're choosing to read. Yeah. Those are good ones to go back to, though.
Yeah. It's so hard, right? When you, like, you know, I mean, it's like a conveyor belt going by, and it's just too fast to grab all the candies off of.
What do you do with your galleys? Because I found that
What should I do with them is the question.
That's also a question. I found that when I started working from home and receiving all my galleys at home, I would receive about 10 a day.
Yes, that sounds right.
And as much as I wanted to put them all in boxes and bring them to Housing Works one day, I could not. It would become like a third job, basically. So I put them on the street.
Oh, okay. I do too. I see a lot of book publicists on Twitter do not like this practice. I, however, see myself as contributing to my local community.
I think so.
You know, the people who I meet on my block, when I finally meet them, they say, "Oh, you're the book lady.
Yeah,
thank you so much."
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to feel like it's a bad thing to be sharing stories.
Wonderful feeling. And
I also like watching what goes first.
Yeah. Or what's
the big, the quote unquote big book never goes first.
Interesting.
On my block. The gluten-free keto books, those actually go immediately. That will go before Lisa Tadeo, say.
Right. That's very funny. Well, we won't tell you where we live, but if you happen to walk by, you might.
Yes. And if anyone wants to put my galley out on the street, I would be very honored.
I love that. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.